WGS 404. Matt Pauly's going to be here about 4:15. I'll let he and Wheels go crazy talking about sports. Stairway to Kevin?
Sure. We did a little bit of fun, like, history-based science earlier. You want to do some more history-based science?
Sure.
So I put this on the rundown, but I think this is just absolutely fascinating. So there's a Harvard researcher that studies, like, early Earth, right? Like, the earliest of the early, like, just single-cell organisms and what was going on in terms of life on the planet way, way back. But this researcher says that the research shows that a meteorite hit Earth, a meteorite the size of four Mount Everests, and that's probably what spurred on the development of complex life. The ingredients in that meteor, whatever they were, was essentially what pushed everything beyond single cells and very simple life into what we now see as more complex life. And I just think that's crazy cool.
It is crazy.
Like, you know, I mean, you've heard this for a long time. We've talked about the people will get the kooky thing, like, we are from the stars. Like, but you know what? We kind of are.
Yeah.
Like, we kind of are. Like, like that kind of, and I don't mean it in a, like an aliens came in and made us kind of thing. I mean that it just practically speaking, all of these impacts, all of the things that happened over the development of this rock in this particular part of space, that all comes from everywhere, right? And I think that it's fascinating to look at something that happened 3.2 billion years ago, but we can see it because we can study the rock. We can see that this is not what's normally here, right? There's evidence that this gigantic meteorite hit because there's stuff here that wouldn't normally be of this Earth. And you can see it and measure it and realize that before that thing hit, this is all we can find. Single cell organisms, some life in the oceans, but not complex, not much on the land. And then afterwards, not immediately, of course, but like over eons and eons, probably billions of years, you see the development of much more complex things. And what I love about this type of study, this type of like, and that's what I like about archaeology, what we talked about earlier, is going, there's the two types of research, right? There's research into what's coming. Can we, you know, research into medical techniques and medicines, things that can help in the future, versus the research about what has already happened. And that look into the past is so valuable because the more you understand the way things happened and the way that they went, the more you have an idea of how you can forecast into the future how things are going to go.
And are they saying that it's like panspermia, that it brought life with it, or just that it shook the snow globe up?
I don't believe that it was in my reading of the couple of articles that I saw, my reading of it wasn't that like life was on this meteorite and the life just took hold. It was more that the elements that did not exist here were on this meteorite, and then when mixed with what was already here, basically started the process rolling, where you didn't have the elements necessary to take the next step, mm-hmm. but they were brought in with that. And you think about all of the time that's passed. I know there are people listening like, the Earth's not that old. Yes, it is. And, you know, you can tell because you can look at basically the rock structures and how things have developed over time. But if that kind of thing, this is not about the doomsday scenario of what if another one of those came, because as we mentioned, we now think there might be ways to even deflect those things using the sun, reflecting the sun and having it blow out gases that would change the direction of a giant meteorite. But this is the beginning of this process was random chance based on science, because you can't, unless somebody directed the meteorite into this particular planet. But I find it fascinating that we can actually learn that stuff,
mm-hmm.
that we can actually go that deep. And if there's an area, because we've now hit two, just the beginning of life and then archaeology, which is more about the study of life that we know existed. Is there an area you'd like to find out more about from the past scientifically? Like, it doesn't matter what it is. It can fall into those categories. Because the one with the meteorite, that's the big, you know, it covers everything. It's the umbrella, like how did life begin and why did it, you know, what caused it? But then there's the other part that once life has started, what happened? You know, so archaeology, we're studying humans. We're studying what we did or what the animals that we interacted did. Or, yeah, I guess not even just humans, right? I mean, you're studying dinosaurs and all the things that came before that. And all the commonalities. Like, you see I know I brought this up to you guys off the air. Like, all of the cultures around the world have dragons, right? There's some form of a dragon in South America, in Asia, like these, all in Europe, all these continents that were not connected, peoples that we didn't think interacted with each other, and maybe they didn't. It could be as simple as they dug up dinosaurs, right? I mean, like, they were digging a house, and they're like, oh, what's that thing? Holy crap, that looks like a monster. And then these same visuals come out. Now, I don't know how they all came up with the same color green and all that kind of stuff.
Or even like megalodon teeth.
Right. You could see it. Right. Giant shark teeth. I mean, things along those lines. What, if you could look into something specific into this, would you look into anything specific? Like any one development more curious to you? Like, to me, the one I like the most is the development of society and when we started to group together and what we knew and how we did it. And where did we get the ideas to stack these stones on top of each other to build not just a structure to live in, but to build something that's just symbolic.
Yeah.
Whether it's religious or it's cultural or it's just, I don't know, we think we can get closer to the sky.
I find it fascinating. Religious people would say, well, duh, we're in the Goldilocks zone because that's the way God intended. And he put us here so that we could have a few thousand years of civilization. Then Jesus comes back and, you know, the monkey's dead. I look at it more like the one thing I have not studied, just watched a lot of shows on, is the way the earth was formed. And for the great, great majority of the earth's life, it was completely uninhabitable.
Right, right.
It was just lava or volcanoes, or it was covered in ice. Mm-hmm. And that just fascinates me that now, and it used to be bombarded just like every few seconds you're getting hit by a stadium-sized asteroid. And now that's so few and far between. We haven't had a giant one for 65 million years, and the temperatures used to be a furnace, or it used to be, you know, 100 degrees below zero, and now it's so relatively temperate that we complain about hurricanes. I understand why. We complain about tornadoes. I get it. But they're just so infrequent based on how the earth has developed. And we happen to be living during this time.
It makes me think about, too, like the way that we look at the world, right? Like we look at, and you can take this into politics or just in regular life, but the reality of our planet and our species and all species is change is the only constant, right? But we don't necessarily experience it that way because we're only occupying this tiny little space on that timeline. You know, something that might take 1,000 years to happen, we're never going to see it happen. You know, we're not going to see it change. So when we think about trying to keep things the way that they are, that is not the natural order of things.
True.
It just isn't. The earth underneath us is moving constantly. The tectonic plates are shifting. The one thing that is constant about our planet is nothing stays the same. Yet in our own little weird way, we want to try to control things and make them stay the same. And it might seem like that because most of these changes take thousands and thousands, if not millions of years to happen. But we feel like we can fight that tide, and I find that funny.
I saw this today. Interesting. I apologize. I don't know the gentleman's name, but he's one of the leading rabbis in Israel. And from my days of being a fervent Christian, Rach, you remember Gog and Magog and all that stuff about the end of the world in Revelation? Or I guess from the Old Testament, because it's a Jewish rabbi talking about the Talmud. But this is supposed to hasten the entrance of the Mashiach, the Messiah, that, of course, Jewish people don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. And it was supposed to happen this morning. It was supposed to happen over the course of 3 hours, pre-dawn. I'm not sure pre-dawn where, maybe Israel. The Gog and Magog go to war, and then the Messiah comes, and it didn't happen. But millions of people believed it.
But we checked?
Yeah, didn't happen.
We're sure it didn't? Okay.
Pretty sure. Yeah. Probably would have made the news.
Okay.
Well, you never know. We got politics to talk about.
Belief is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Because I've been there. I have been a very devout believer before and witnessed to people and talked about Revelation and Jesus will be back in 1981 and here's why. And so I get it. I'm not judging. I get it. But it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah. I agree.
Was your church very
end times
returning? Yeah.
Not really.
No?
No, I mean, like, it was something that was talked about from time to time, but I was always taught that it was kind of silly to look out for signs like that because Christ is coming back like a thief in the night. So he's going to come at a time where you least expect it. So anything that's like showing up and, you know, seems like a sign is probably not that. So
yeah, I was taught similarly in like Catholic school.
Yeah, I don't remember it being much of a topic in Catholic school.
Yeah, it was just the exact same thing. It's like it's pointless to look for signs. You're not going to know when it happens anyway. It's just going to happen. So don't waste your time.
There's Jesus calling right now.
There we go. That's our sign.
Welcome back, guys. DGS on Camo X. Our buddy Matt Pauly's here from the sports department. So Wheels was telling me that Mazalek said a couple things yesterday that leads one to believe that maybe the retooling could be bigger and more comprehensive than what we thought.
Yeah, because our big question going in was, are they cutting salaries simply by letting contracts walk away? Paul Goldschmidt, Kyle Gibson, Lance Lynn, or are they cutting salary to an extent where that plus removing contracts, Nolan Arenado, Wilson Contreras, Sonny Gray being moved on from, and they have not officially stated anything, but when Mo was asked about that yesterday, he didn't answer the question, but he finished the question by saying, but we expect there to be many opportunities for younger players, or something. That's a paraphrase of mm-hmm. what he said. So that tells me they are ready to offload some of these contracts.
What would be the strategy if they did do that? If they unloaded, if they let the guys walk and they unloaded two or three big contracts, what's the strategy there?
I'm sure it's a balance sheet thing where they're looking at the expenditure that goes along with beefing up staff, beefing up technology, all the capital money that's going to go towards the rebuild of the spring training complex. And they're, in their minds, from a profit and loss statement, they're going to take some of the money from Major League payroll and redirect it to that. That's what they're saying. I would push back on that a little bit. I think they've got money for everything. But they also, I think, This is a transitional year where they're going to start the process of becoming whatever they're going to become. So why would they go spend tons of money on major league contracts when that's not really part of the future?
So Kev has talked a lot about, as recently as yesterday's show, that the fans are not to blame in any way because the Cardinals make a promise. Like you said, if you go to Capital Grill, they're making a promise. This is going to be the best steak you've ever had, and they need to deliver or else you go, it was subpar. Do you expect them to give a more tempered approach to next year when they start rolling out what's going to happen?
I think they'll keep repeating what they have been so far, but some of it depends on how big it goes, right? Like if you roll in next, like let's say we get to the winter warmup and you're getting ready for spring training and Wilson Contreras is still on the team and Sonny Gray is still on the team and Nolan Arenado is still on the team and all you've really done is let the contracts leave that could leave. Well, then you probably are going to have a bit of a message where, you know, we think with some things going right, we can still win this division or we can still be in the postseason. If some of those end up being traded, it might change that message a little bit. So I think today it's hard to know exactly how they're going to be when it comes to that specific message. I have a feeling, though, that it's going to be a little more guarded message than it's been in the past, where in the past it's we expect to be a contender. I'm not sure it's going to be as definitive anymore. But I think that's okay. Like to me, what I would be looking at here is on this team, this is not a 5 or 6 year rebuild. You could turn this around in a year or two by making smarter moves, by finding younger, inexpensive guys that can be good, and then supplementing that with the high end players too, rather than constantly buying in the middle. When you're buying in the middle, you're overspending. You're overspending for middling production. You want to spend at the top end, not in the middle. That's where the best teams are
which is what we've done.
Right. I mean, you look at the Dodgers and the Yankees. Yeah, they spend in the middle because they can, but what makes them awesome is that they got Juan Soto and Aaron Judge, and they spend on Mookie Betts, and they spend on Shohei Ohtani. Like, you spend at the top, you save in the middle, and obviously you want to fill in from the younger guys, and that's more important for a St. Louis than it is for a New York. It's more important for a Cleveland than it is for an L.A., and that can get there pretty quick, but if you look ahead, this should be an aggressive offseason. This could be, hey, if someone's going to offer us something good for Brendan Donovan, we're probably going to do it because J.J. Weatherholt's going to be here soon. So, and we don't need to hold a spot until then. We can just fast forward a little bit.
I don't expect you to know the Cardinals' balance sheet, but if we did spend like that, and we won a couple of World Series within 7 years of each other, would that pay for the Shohei Ohtanis of the world?
No, they can never play at that level.
No.
You cannot play it. I mean, Shohei's different, though, because Shohei's two players, right? That's why he's $70 million a year. Most top players are 40. But you know what you could play in? You could play in the range that Bryce Harper was in when he signed. You can play in that 12, 13, 14 year, $28 million a year range. Now, that number is probably now 38 instead of 28, but like, you can
numbers.
You can play, but the only way you can play at that level is if your system is constantly producing inexpensive players at the same time.
And that's why the people they brought in is so important, because Chaim Bloom did that in Tampa. The guys that he brought in Boston are starting to do that. The guy they brought in yesterday, Cleveland's been doing that, especially from a pitching standpoint. That's the goal here.